Okay. Could you start by describing how you came to this field, what your pathway to it was?
Oh, okay. Well, it was very serendipitous, and this is has influenced my reluctance to give advice to people about career paths, because even when I look at other folks' history, it could not have been planned. But my route into the field started when I was inducted into the Army, and as part of the induction procedure, they evaluated people with regard to their background, and I remember in a large auditorium of about 500 people, they said, "Okay, does anyone here speak a foreign language?" And I was one of only two or three people that raised their hand, and so the instructor at the front of the room said, "What language is it?" And I responded, "Swahili." And I was known as Swahili throughout the rest of my basic training. But they sent me to a testing facility, and lo and behold, they had Swahili language examinations there, and foreign service examinations. So I passed that, and as a result, they identified that I should go into military intelligence to be trained to be an interrogator. And I arrived at Fort Hood, Texas, along with several other Mormon gentlemen that had undergone mission experiences in foreign countries and picked up a foreign language. And so we all, after talking, identified that we all had a social science background and had a foreign language proficiency. And so that was apparently key ingredients for that placement. But at Fort Hood, when I was processing through personnel, the personnel specialist said, "Oh no, you have been in the Peace Corps." That's where I learned Swahili. And Peace Corps graduates are restrained by rule from entering any kind of intelligence work for 2 years, moratorium period.
And what year was this?
This was in 1968. So they didn't want foreign countries to think Peace Corps were spies, and so they said, "You can't stay in military intelligence, so where would you like to work during your period of time in the Army? We won't send you back to infantry training. You can stay at Fort Hood." And so the movie MASH had just come out, and I thought that the Medical Corps would be kind of a nice place to spend the 2 years. And so they sent me to the medical course. So I was assigned to what they called a mental hygiene group, which was a psychiatric clinic. And there I was a social work psychology specialist. And we worked with psychiatrists as a group of specialists. And mainly we worked with soldiers that were coming back from Vietnam with heroin habits. Of course, they also had the mainstay of alcohol abuse and dependence problems in the Army. And that was a huge part of our workload, is drug problems and alcohol problems. And so the rest is kind of history. You know, I stayed with that field. When I got out of the Army, I traveled up the road to the University of Texas at Austin, and entered the social work program on the GI Bill, and just continued to build on my initial drug treatment experience and drug involvement experience. And when I graduated from the master's program in social work, before I graduated, my second intern placement was with the new state drug and alcohol agency, which had just been created, and my first job was to draft a state plan for a drug abuse treatment and prevention. And so that was at about the time that Jerry Jaffe had been appointed to be the first drug czar, and was embarking on a program of initiating drug treatment programs throughout the country. In that time, it was methadone. So that was my beginning into the field.
Had you had any kind of training or coursework about addiction prior to, in your earlier...
Not.
Yeah.
Not
had
any
you
coursework.
Known anybody? Had you ever had any kind of interaction?
No
with
interaction,
addicted
no
people?
Contact, no family history, nothing of a personal nature that led me to be interested in, no previous exposure to the issues in the field. So it was not a planned thing.
Mm-hmm. And what was the state of knowledge at that point in the field?
Yeah, the state of knowledge at that point, that was when the, I forget the exact title, but the drug treatment farms were in existence at Fort Worth and in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And so but the information was very thin. So another colleague and I in the Army, we actually traveled to the drug treatment facility in Fort Worth and interviewed people there and toured through the facilities there.
So tell me about it. I know a lot about Lexington, but I've never talked to, anybody who spent more than, very little time at Fort Worth. So what was it like?
Well, it was an institutional setup, and the inmates were there under legal commitment. And it was a quasi-therapeutic community type of arrangement. There was a lot of client self-government infused in it. At Fort Worth, there were clinicians clearly that had the controlling hand, but there was a lot of self-government there among the clients, inmates, and the senior ones clearly had a lot of influence and control over what actually happened and on the behavior of the others, and we actually observed that and were wondering how free and open the interviews were with the counselors with the participants, the subjects, the patients, because we did it in a group format, and the senior patients seemed to exert some influence over what the others said and exercise some editing and interpretation of what the others said in group. Now, we did do some individual interviews as well, but we worried just a little bit that what we got might have been kind of sanitized a bit.
And did you do anything with that? Do you still have it? Did you publish it?
No, we didn't publish it. We were just doing that as a staff training thing, just to kind of try to get up to speed with what's going on in the field. And that was the main thing that we identified that would be helpful. There was not that, and that was about the extent of it. We did literature reviews, and actually it was mainly brochures and pamphlets and that sort of thing. So that's what we did.
So what did you learn from people at Fort Worth?
Well, that's a good question. We learned that, at least we reached the conclusion that group activities were the thing to do, we thought, at least it's something that we should adopt, or at least try out. And we were kind of enthusiastic about the dynamic that we saw, even with our apprehensions about how accurate it was. But we saw that the dynamic seemed to be useful as well. And so when we went back, we did go through an approval process to actually start groups among our clientele. Previous to that time, we only had individual one-on-one sessions. And so we went back and we had to go through an approval process to do groups. And then we also had to go through a rather arduous approval process to get approval to do a marathon group sessions. That was something that that they did at Fort Worth, and we got approval to do that as well. Actually, I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
Now, what were they?
Well, that was where you do group all night. You start in the afternoon, you do group all night. And the idea was that you could have breakthroughs in the progress of patients through the intensity, but also the continued adversity, in a sense, of this process. And the people kind of got worn down. And part of the thinking at that time was that TCs were good because, for at least chronic and hardcore folks, because they broke through some existing patterns over the long course of the course of treatment or the course of involvement, and that was a good thing. And so we thought that by kind of accelerating the tension and the pressure of the peers and so forth, that the marathon session would do that, would get at that.
Did it?
Oh, no, I don't think so. It was just kind of a interesting experience.
So when you set up basically a treatment program that was multimodality, did you have methadone and TCs?
There were actually one or two methadone clients that was really extended detox. And these were soldiers that brought back a supply of heroin with them from Vietnam. And then when they started to get low on their supply, apparently there was very little examination of duffel bags and so forth coming back. Then they would, some of them went to their physicians on base and asked if they could get on methadone. And there was one or two that was approved for. Very different environment than what exists now.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you run that program?
Well, it continued for my tenure, which was 2 years, and I don't know how long. But some form of it existed quite a long time after I left. I didn't make very many visits back after I left that program. But yeah, you're right. It was multimodality. The primary modality was outpatient. Then it shifted more and more toward group, just regular hour-long group meetings. The marathon group experience was experiment. Never became a part of the standard treatment there.
So what did you do after that? What was your next step?
Well, I mentioned that I went to graduate school after that and got involved in planning. So it started out with a planning task. When I graduated, I became employed by the state agency and continued in a planning role with them. So that started the pattern that has continued through the rest of my career, being involved with data and planning. Mm-hmm. And we had the notion back then that by planning, you really could develop programs and systems that would have a beneficial effect and make an impact on things. Subsequently, became somewhat disillusioned with planning and developed the opinion that most planning activities are just activities to document and justify and express decisions that have already been made by administration.
So do you still work for the state agency?
No, I worked with them for quite a long time. I went to work for the National Institute on Drug Abuse and the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse in administrative capacities. And then I went back with the state and briefly was state director of the drug program. And my most recent involvement with the state was as director of research and technology transfer, which position I held for about 16 years.
Okay.
And then I left that about 4 years ago to go to the University of Texas School of Social Work, which is where I am now.
Okay. So when did you go to NIDA? You went to D.C.?
Yeah, I went to D.C. I was recruited initially, I guess it was with the NIAAA.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, that was my initial stint with the feds.
When was that?
In the late 70s, or mid-70s, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a program they call them program administrators, but they were project officers. And that was when the federal government funded, that was when NIH funded treatment. So NIAAA had treatment programs, alcoholism treatment programs throughout the country. So I worked evaluating and monitoring treatment programs in Kentucky and Tennessee and North and South Carolina.
And when did you also do the same thing when you went to NIDA?
No, I after a period of time, I left NIAAA to go back to the state to be the state director. And then after a period of time, I went to work for the National Institute on Drug Abuse in the office of the director in the policy development.
And who
function.
Was that at that point?
It was Bill Pollin, P-O-L-L-I-N.
So you were there in 70.
That was in the. Six. That was in 78 or 79, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And then I got caught up in the Reagan riff of 1980.
The Reagan riff.
Yeah.
All right.
When Reagan was elected, he instituted a reduction in force, government wide, mm-hmm. and my tenure with the federal government had never consisted of three contiguous years.
Yeah.
So I never achieved career status by the time that RIF happened. So so rather than try to stay on in some kind of a clerical role, you know, bumping down, and that was even chancy, I just decided to go back to Texas.
Mm-hmm. So that time, that stint with NIDA under Pollin was how long?
Like it was about a year.
A year? 1 year?
Yeah.
And what
year and a half.
What did you see then? What was that like? What did you
believe? That was an interesting period of time. And that was during some of the Reagan was there during the first part of that time as well. And I was in the policy branch. It was very interesting. We had to develop one-page papers. And no matter how complex the issue was, it could be no longer than one page. If you couldn't reduce it to one page, then your thinking is fuzzy, and you need to work on it some more. So I remember I had to draft a one-page paper on adolescent drug problems, and it was pretty difficult to reduce it down to one.
Now, by that point, had you have a specific interest in adolescents, or
no? That was just the topic du jour.
Yes, right. Right. So tell me, back to NIAAA and the move towards separating out treatment from research. Right, so now SAMHSA, you know, you have a separate agency dealing primarily with treatment and a separate agency dealing with research. What do you make of that, kind of splitting the two away?
Well, it's awkward. It's awkward, I think, for both SAMHSA and for NIDA, NIAAA, because there's some natural overlap between treatment and research. And clearly, on programs that are funded for services should have an expectation to do as rigorous as evaluation as they can, and also to help move toward science. I mean, the services to science directionality needs to be assisted with folks that have some research capability and knowledge. On NIDA's side, and in NIAAA's side, they also have an inherent interest that their studies get transmitted to practice, and that they're understood and used by clinicians. So I think the blending, whole blending terminology is one way of addressing all of that. And I think that has worked to varying degrees, but with its limitations, it doesn't reach as far as it perhaps could. There's some thoughts that I know more and more researchers have about the limitations of improvement of quality of services through our traditional research strategies.
Can you be a little more specific about that?
Well, some of the research that's been large-scale research that's been done, the naturalistic studies of Simpson and others that have looked at the effectiveness of treatment as usual, have built a pretty good case that treatment as usual is pretty good. Some of the other studies, such as Project Match and others, have suggested that the differential effectiveness of one evidence-based method compared to another is pretty small. And that has led some of us to speculate that perhaps improvements in quality and outcomes can be more strategically addressed by looking at other factors which are generic to all programs, such as the counselor variables or process variables and organizational processes and variables. So there's some research in that area, but it's a little bit different. Simpson's organizational readiness instrument, such as his focus on clinical treatment processes that you can describe and test and address, which are independent of the interventions that are used within those processes. But those are two useful ways to go, and they may contribute more to the incremental improvement in quality as a result of their application than trying to get an organization to drop whatever it's doing and adopt an evidence-based practice that it doesn't presently use. We also have apprehensions that since treatment as usual is pretty good, that in adopting an evidence-based practice and discarding what you're presently doing might not be a net improvement, mm-hmm. especially if it inhibits some of the good things that they're doing and some of the skills and capabilities of the good counselors that may be operating there.
So you've seen critique of evidence-based, this attempt to infuse evidence-based practices. You're seeing some reason not to.
I understand we were talking about the separation of services from research, and I think that the focus on trying to transfer the adoption of specific evidence-based practice, such as motivational interviewing, which is a terrific evidence base, that could benefit from very, very close involvement with the treatment services as well, so that other things are also addressed, mm-hmm. other than just the adoption of a specific practice.
Right. So as you know, there have been all kinds of initiatives to try to build infrastructures for doing this, the CTNs, the ATTCs. Do you think we have the infrastructures that we need to do that?
I think those are very healthy developments, and that's a good sign. I think that the fact that they're happening is a reflection that there's general awareness of the issues that I was talking about. And I think that we're probably at the very early stages of how that will evolve.
So let me ask you: you have what you've described so far is a career trajectory where you went from a state of knowledge, both in your individual knowledge and in the field, of relatively little, to an increasing sophistication of both the sort of methodologies by which we measure these things and produce data. Would you say, can you sort of, I don't know, give me a sense of the kinds of methodologies that you've seen promise in, like over those years, the ones that have become crucial in your view? Which ones are they?
Well, I have to just think about that for a second.
Okay.
Well, the one, of course, that we started with was method on maintenance. And it took off rather quickly when Nixon initiated that program. And there was a pretty rapid uptake of that by the places that that were compatible with that approach in terms of the values and politics and so forth. More recently, you know, the motivational interviewing seems to have caught fire for and diffused essentially on its own because of the advantages that it seems to have.
And why? Why is that?
Well, in my observation, it seems to be something that managed care loves because it's a short, it provides a promise of a short-term intervention that can have measurable effects. I think it resonates very well with what many counselors think they do anyway. It resonates well with traditional methods, you know, the Rogerian tradition, at least in social work and other counseling approaches. And it seems like something that should be easy to learn, you know, for those that haven't really gotten into it yet. It's something that it's an idea which they can understand pretty quickly, at least the superficial parts of it. That's my general take on why it's, and also the positive results that have been announced about it. Also because it's an outpatient thing, which is also cheap, relatively cheap.
Yeah. So those two approaches have been the sort of main evidence-based practices, or?
Of course, in the residential care, the therapeutic communities, and their adoption by criminal justice approaches in inpatient seem to have been well established, convincingly established as great approaches for those for whom all other approaches seem to not work. Mm-hmm. The chronically addicted, failed at treatment multiple times, population. So that seems to work. The one area that we've not addressed very well is group therapy techniques, and there's more attention, thankfully, being addressed on that. A lot of our studies and interventions are designed around individual one-on-one approaches. So, but most of the treatment is nowadays group. So those are just, without preparation, some of the things that leap to mind.
Yeah. And as a researcher, what are the sort of main questions that motivate you now?
Well, now I'm primarily motivated by the process improvement issues. And so all the stuff that I'm involved in now deal with assessing organizational characteristics that should be addressed as kind of the foundation for improving specific techniques and abilities. So we use the Simpson's Organizational Readiness for Change. Actually, it's the Survey of Organizational Functioning. It's kind of a diagnostic tool for helping managers and supervisors identify areas of organizational development that they need to address as preparation for adopting and improving evidence-based methods of the clinicians. The other process-oriented thing that we are doing in multiple projects is, again, using Simpson's, primarily his CEST, the Client Evaluation of Self in Treatment, as a diagnostic tool for looking at the processes within treatment that may need to be focused on as possible things that are not happening in a process way in the treatment program that the program can then look at and then search for evidence-based techniques and methods out there that can address the process glitches that may not be working in the program. For example, if people are coming into treatment unmotivated, and then the CEST, if you look at clients that have been in treatment for quite some time, and still are not, don't think they need treatment, then that means that the motivational issues are not being addressed successfully, and perhaps the motivational interviewing push, motivational enhancement initiative would make sense. So that's one of the approaches that we're using. So a lot of process kind of assessment.
And do you work closely with Simpson?
Work very closely with his group, you know, Pat Flynn and George Joe and Grace Rowensall and Kevin Knight and that group, we also have an addiction technology transfer award from CSAT. So that's a big part of what we do is to help promote adoption of evidence-based practices. Mm-hmm. We don't, at the University of Texas, in Texas, we don't have a CTN close by. At least we didn't until this month. And there's just a new award that has gone out to a group in Dallas. So we'll be establishing a close relationship with them. Not having one, though, we focused on the TCU group as kind of our pseudo-CTN, mm-hmm. At least Center of Research, to work with them and help promote adoption and utilization of their work.
Right.
So it's been a kind of a happy coincidence.
Right, so there's a very interesting example of a research to practice kind of movement that's been relatively successful.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because Duane doesn't have treatment programs. You know,
right.
He's not operating from a clinical
base. That was
going
to be my next question.
Yeah.
Was
and so
what enabled
so,
him to
But he's been involved in these national studies, which are, again, naturalistic studies. But his work is generalizable because all of his work has been with real-life programs in real places without changing their interventions. So the findings from his stuff and the data from all these surveys are widely applicable. So that's the advantage of that kind of approach. It's not testing out specific interventions, but I think it's valid for looking at overall considerations and process thinking. I forgot what your question was.
Well, does that just happen? Or was there some sort of, is that serendipity? Or was there some intent to make sure that these findings were generalizable?
It was our intent to help promote that, in our HTC function. And it's really odd. The TCU webpage is really a very good one because they have all their instruments there free of charge. They have all their PowerPoints and their articles referenced and their manuals are there free of charge. It's all a totally public domain website. And very few people know about it and use it because no one has a financial incentive to promote that stuff. Mm-hmm. Other things get promoted and used widely that are not as good because they have a marketing incentive. So a lot of Duane's stuff, his assessments and so forth, which are free, are better than some of the stuff people are paying for now, like the off the record. The SASSI, SASSI, which is a private proprietary thing, and it has flaws in it. You know, it doesn't stand up as well in the psychometrics as some of Simpson's record back on the record.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably one of the good rationales for having for funding something like the ATTCs. To do that sort of thing, to promote awareness and knowledge and even produce evidence, of its usefulness of that stuff that's been developed by taxpayer money and promote adoption and use of that.
Mm-hmm. So you earlier alluded to having a sense of disillusionment when it came to planning. You, as you talk, you seem to have a great sense of optimism about the adoption of practices that will lead to process and quality improvement. Where does that come from?
I mean, the optimism.
Yeah. I mean, you've seen a lot in this field. The field has changed dramatically during the time you've been in it.
I guess it comes from from the evidence that I've seen from Simpson's group, but also from the response of providers that we work with, that they seem to resonate very well. At least managers seem to resonate very well to the things that they learn from it, and they report that it helps them to make management decisions that appear to be related to improved quality of functioning of the organization and of the treatment program. But it also springs from kind of the skepticism, my previous skepticism, that our work in evidence-based practices really doesn't result in higher quality outcomes in general for clients. It just seems like a very logical and hopeful way to think about improving the stuff that we do, and it's consistent with a lot of the conventional wisdom in the field that a good counselor, doesn't make any difference what technique they use, that a counselor that can establish rapport, a good counselor will have good outcomes. A bad counselor, quote, will have bad outcomes no matter what technique they're using. And also the kind of the conventional wisdom that's around that, you know, a toxic organization inhibits good outcomes no matter how, well, not no matter how, but that a toxic organization can really limit the effectiveness of the good counselors that might be there and the good techniques that the counselors may use. And we all kind of know this from experience, most of us having experienced organizations in which the morale was low and staff fought with each other and there were not adequate support for some of the key things that needed to happen. Mm-hmm. So having lived through organizational angst in a bunch of places and having observed a kind of counselor frustration in a lot of cases, not being able to do the things that they knew would be helpful, it just seemed like that these are logical answers to some of those continuing problems in the field.
So let's sort of close, if we can, with the counselors themselves. Have you observed anything that you would characterize as a workforce crisis? There are many representations of the frontline workforce as sort of in crisis. Have you observed that?
Continually observe that. I would refer you to Tom McClellan's article on workforce issues if you haven't seen that. But what I've continued to observe is extremely high turnover of clinical staff, extremely high turnover of programs in general that are not able to survive managed care, for example, not able to survive the changing rules and funding patterns of state block grant agencies, and the rapid turnover of junior level staff. Through all this, there seems to be a continuing presence of some senior directors and senior staff, which we probably could utilize better as mentors and so forth in the field. But staff turnover is a big problem, and the inability to compete with other service agencies for qualified staff and experienced staff in the face of this, because of the grossly underfunded status of drug treatment in this country, is a continuing problem. That underfunding of treatment, you know, the funding of treatment really hasn't gone up much since Jaffe started since Nixon started the war on drugs way back then. It's just, matter of fact, I know that it has not kept up with anywhere close to inflation, and it was just barely adequate back then. But another effect of the underfunding is programs cannot afford to adopt the new evidence-based medication methods, for sure. They can't afford naltrexone. They can't afford buprenorphine. These are programs that serve the indigent population, talking about primarily. So though the medication didn't cost much, they have absolutely no margin, no cost margin to operate from. So that's one of the other kind of pessimistic, very pessimistic things that we're faced with. So with a rapidly turning over workforce, we're all doing real good just to train them in the administrative things they need to know about how to function within an organization. It's very hard to keep folks long enough to really grow them into senior clinicians that are equipped with a toolkit of evidence-based practices that they then know how to apply in individualizing treatment with different clients based on the kind of needs that they have.
Mm-hmm. So I thought of one more question, and that is, when did you get involved with CPDD, and what's the experience of attending this meeting like for you, being on the sort of treatment side of things?
I started attending CPDD only about 5 years ago. Mm. But it has really been very helpful to me in linking with other researchers that look at the similar kind of issues. So, and every year that I've come, I've built on those links that most of our conversations are at CPDD.
Yeah, that's great. So it has, in effect, become an organization that's able to look beyond basic science.
Sure. And just the techniques they have about grouping the posters, you know, by topic. Mm-hmm. And there's always, like, if there's a technology transfer topic, there'll be others close by, comorbidity. Mm-hmm. There'll be folks there, too. And those of us that think the same way that I was talking, you know, we have found each other out, and so it does help that a great deal. And we're scattered all over the country, mm-hmm. and yeah. So it does help that a great deal, and helps to kind of forward the projects and collaborations that we would like to do. I was talking with a colleague this morning about and we developed an idea about, yeah, that would make a lot of sense to do that as the next logical thing to do based on what we've been doing. And I said, yeah, I remarked to him, you know, I had this thought about 3 months ago when I was running, but when I got home, I got distracted, blah, blah, blah. So here you have time to interact, think about it, and then actually make plans to take the next step and follow through on it. So
that's great. Can you think of anything else that you would want to say to me or that I should have asked?
That's a good question. Well, you might ask folks like who they think of are the key historical events, mm-hmm. or landmarks in the drug treatment research or key folks. You started me thinking about key folks the other day, and so I always think about Jaffe as someone that I thought was a terrific appointment. Someone that has deep clinical roots and already thought about a lot of this stuff, kind of knew what he wanted to do.
Yes.
Kick-started a bunch of initiatives and related, and it was based on research. So when Jaffe came in, he was able to say, you know, he's based a lot of his thinking on the work of blah, blah, blah. Was Dolan Nice Wonder was recently out to it. So that really kicked off the methadone stuff. George De Leon and his TC research. Dwayne Simpson's predecessor, Saul Sells, S-E-L-L-S, was one of the key folks, I think, in the from an epi point of view. And then there's a lot of others, but these are ones that jump out at me.
Well, that's very helpful.
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting process. I hope you have a good luck with your other folks.
Oh, I'm sure. I'd like you to begin by describing your pathway into the field of addiction research.
When I was a psychiatric resident at the University of Minnesota, in about 1964, there was a very active training program, postdoctoral fellowship, sponsored by NIMH, and led by Dr. Travis Thompson. That was mostly PhDs who were in that postdoctoral training program. I was in a psychiatric residency, and I was interested in doing research, and so I was encouraged to go attend some of their seminars, and I became quite involved with those people and got to know them very well, took courses from them, learned a lot about the behavioral analysis of drug self-administration, and began doing animal research in their laboratories. That was kind of the first most active professional move early in my career.
And prior to that time, had you had any interest in the addictions?
Not from a professional standpoint. I came from a family that was very severely stained with alcohol dependence, and one of my parents died of complications of alcohol dependence. And there's no question that colored my view. I certainly did not go into psychiatry with the intention of practicing in substance dependence. I didn't go to medical school with the intention of practicing in psychiatry. But I did sort of realize along the way, I probably had some feel for an understanding of issues of substance dependence based on that long experience during childhood.
And can you tell me a little bit about what it was like working with Travis Thompson?
Yeah. Travis was an extremely bright, extremely thorough, very obsessive man, which was characteristic of people doing laboratory research on Skinnerian operant conditioning. And Travis and Bob Schuster were in the process of writing a book, which was kind of a classic in the field. And both of them had recently done postdoctoral fellowships with Joe Brady, who was sort of a pioneer in all of that. And only two or three years earlier, the first study had been done in which it was shown that animals would work to self-administer drugs via indwelling cannulae. And I learned a lot from Travis, first in terms of the lingo of operant conditioning and also the kind of obsessive concern with the control of environment that was characteristic of the research in those days. I had done my undergraduate training at the University of Minnesota, which was a strong center for the study of Skinnerian operant conditioning. So I was a little bit primed for all of that before I got there.
And can you tell me tell me something about research design in that laboratory. How did it take place? Did you tend to propose ideas and then talk through them and then organize the experiments? Did you tinker with the apparatus? I mean, what do you remember from the way laboratory life took place there?
Well, remember that I was primarily a psychiatric resident. I was off across the street in the hospital taking care of patients. I was encouraged to do some research, but I was really different from a postdoctoral fellow or a grad student who was like full time in the laboratory. I had certain ideas about the interaction of physiology and behavior, and I was encouraged to pursue those, I think, with a certain sense of benign amusement. But people were doing odd things in that laboratory. Travis was trying to